One of every seven Medicare beneficiaries who's hospitalized is harmed as a result of problems with the medical care there. That's according to a study last year from the Office of the Inspector General and the Department of Health and Human Services. The study said what are called unexpected adverse events add at least $4.4 billion a year to government health costs and contribute to the deaths of about 180,000 patients a year. Good morning. You're listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Steve Brown, sitting in for Ann Fisher today. In this hour, why hospitals' mistakes happen, who pays for them, how they're handled, and how they can be prevented. Later in the hour, we'll talk with Mark Crafton from the Joint Commission, the independent nonprofit that accredits and certifies hospitals around the U.S. We'll also be talking with the Chief Medical Officer of the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. But joining us now is David Engler. He's Vice President of the Ohio Hospital Association's Quality Institute, which in its mission statement says it works to improve health care quality and patient safety in Ohio. Welcome to the show, David.
Thank you.
This is a big question, but how exactly are Ohio hospitals regulated? Peel off the layers of regulation from a local to a national level. Exactly what is the oversight that exists for hospitals?
Well, thank you. The oversight that exists there are that hospitals in Ohio are registered by the Ohio Department of Health, and each institution is registered with them. Psychiatric services and newborn services are licensed in Ohio through the Ohio Department of Health. And as a registered hospital, you could choose to become registered by being certified by the Joint Commission or by certified by CMS rules and regulations.
What is the difference between a certification and a license? What's the practical difference for these facilities?
Not much, really. Ohio is one of the only states that doesn't have licensure. We do have registration, and there's really no difference between the two.
Why is there a difference between states? Why is there this patchwork?
It's not really a patchwork. It's really about how you can best apply existing regulations, existing certifications, and requirements and accreditation standards in Ohio. Ohio has a very vast history of quality improvement and accreditation. All of our hospitals, majority of our hospitals are accredited directly by the Joint Commission. Some are accredited and certified through CMS.
Generally speaking, in regard to the overall quality of the hospitals here in Ohio, how does the state stack up to others? I know we have some nationally known facilities like the James Cancer Institute, the Cleveland Clinic, and some others, just to name a couple. But overall, how do we compare?
Well, we compare very well. We have, as a matter of fact, we have 10 of the top 15 health systems in the country here in Ohio. We do have a long way to go, though, still. We have issues relating to hospital-acquired infections. We have issues that hospitals are working on in order to make sure that all appropriate care is rendered by all of our hospitals. We rank very well on process of care measures that the Joint Commission and CMS measure each and every quarter by our facilities. We rank very well on outcomes of care. AMI in particular, heart care is very well developed and received in this state. But there are other things that we need improvement on. Readmission rates, for instance, and we've worked very closely with a core of 18 hospitals to improve our readmission rates in those facilities, mostly around improving transitions of care, patients moving from hospitals to home to nursing care facilities, and improving those transitions in order to avoid them having to come back to hospitals.
Listeners, give us a call. Do you have a story to share about a hospital? Are you okay with hospital care in Ohio? Do you think it needs improvement? Personal stories, please give us a call at 614-292-8513. And you can also send an email to allsides@wosu.org. And you can also look up the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Getting back to the so-called unexpected adverse events or serious reportable events, or what are sometimes referred to as never events. Basically, hospital mistakes are things that should never happen in a hospital. Tell us exactly what we're talking about here. What are some of the most basic mistakes or the most common mistakes that we see in hospitals?
Well, let me focus a little bit of the attention on what we're doing to avoid those mistakes. Ohio has a vast history dating back to the 90s of working with collaboratives of hospitals coming together, sharing practices on how they can best care for patients and improve quality and get the outcomes that our hospitals want and our patients deserve. And it's through these collaborations that we have, and we have over five collaboratives going statewide at this time, that hospitals share information on how to avoid mistakes. Wrong site surgery is a classic example. We developed years ago the first statewide protocol around wrong site surgery, which requires our hospitals and our physicians to accurately identify the patient, the site, the location of the surgery. We even have the patient mark the surgical site themselves. We have timeouts in the surgery to make sure that everybody at the table understands who the patient is, what they're there for, and what service they're going to be receiving during that procedure. So these are steps, protocols that have been developed. Evidence around those protocols are very strong. They reduce the likelihood of error in the system, and so we work very diligently with our hospitals and our physicians to make sure that that occurs.
And as unfortunate as these events may be, they do happen. What's the protocol for OHA, for the Ohio Hospital Association, and for your Quality Institute when, as far as reporting and measuring these events?
Well, first of all, the quality of Ohio hospitals is measured and monitored at various levels. At the state level, we report to the State Department of Health over 104 measures of quality, and those are posted on a website that the Ohio Department of Health has, 104 measures. In addition, CMS has a website, Hospitals Compare Themselves, compare.gov is a website that is operated by CMS that has other measures that the public can see. So transparency is a supported issue by our hospitals in Ohio, making information that is actionable, that contributes to knowledge about hospital care, is supported by our institutions. So in the work that we are attempting to do in reducing those errors, that's a part of it. But more importantly, the part of it is to make sure that systems are in place so that errors do not occur. Medication safeties are another example of that. Your viewers and the folks that listen in on your radio know that when they get medications from their physicians, the physician checks to make sure that there's no contraindications of those medications. Your pharmacist also makes sure that those are in place, and hospitals have computerized assisted systems established to make sure that there are no drug interactions, et cetera. So all to reduce medication errors from occurring. We also encourage all of our patients to make sure that they understand what the medications are that they are on, to use those according to the way their physicians have asked them to use it and prescribed it, and to always to have conversations with their physicians and with their caregivers on the appropriate use of medication. Patients and all folks that are involved in this have responsibility around medication issues as well as healthcare. In the wrong site surgery case, as I mentioned, it's the responsibility of the patient to accurately identify why they're in there for the procedure and to take place in the marking of the site. I know when I was recently in for a surgical procedure, I had to mark the site of my surgery to make sure that the physicians and everybody there knew who I was, what I was there for on the site.
When a mistake does happen, it's my understanding, at least in Ohio, a lot of the reporting is voluntary. A lot of states around the country, Minnesota was the first a few years ago, to institute mandatory hospital reporting of these type events. And as you can explain this more than I can, but a lot of that mandatory reporting does not exist in Ohio. Why is that?
Well, in some cases, mandatory reporting actually drives down the reporting of events.
How is that?
Because the likelihood that you would be taken to task, you would be reprimanded, you would be sued, et cetera, can drive down that reporting system. So what you see in other states that might have mandatory reporting on these events may be a lower rate, true rate of occurrence than there actually is. Now, with Ohio and our hospitals in particular, if there is an error that occurs, we encourage our physicians and our staff to have a conversation with the patient right away to make sure that the patient knows what had occurred. We expect that the communication is honest and open and that all steps are taken in the next set of procedures to correct that error and to come forward and to be very honest and open about the error that occurred. So there are encouragements in place, policies that encourage the non-payment for those events and encourage in particular the fact that a conversation would occur with the patient and with their family. The other part of this is to make sure that there is a direct connection and a learning that takes place so that the event does not occur again. The reason why we have protocols on wrong site surgery and verification protocols is that events did occur. We're working very closely with our member hospitals now on reducing bloodstream infections that occur because of insertions of catheters. This is a very large issue, a very important issue, very important public health issue, and very important safety issue. And working with our member hospitals, we've been able to reduce by half, and we're now below the national average bloodstream infections, just working on protocols for insertion of those catheters to make sure that everything is done in preparation for that insertion. Now, that was discovered by Johns Hopkins after an event that occurred at Johns Hopkins. Bloodstream infection occurred there, and we have all joined together as a hospital community to drive those infections down.
Listeners, have you had a wrong size surgery? Have you had a wrong type of blood transfusion? Have you had any major hospital mistake? Please give us a call, 614-292-8513. Again, 292-8513. And you can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. I'm reading from MedPage today, the online publication. Data on hospital-acquired conditions collected by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, was originally scheduled to be published in September of last year, but was met with strong resistance from hospital groups such as the American Hospital Association. The groups say that CMS never made specifics available on how it calculates the hospital-acquired condition rates. Is the Ohio Hospital Association and the Quality Institute in line with that, with having a problem the way CMS originally planned to publish the reporting of these events?
Well, you know, we work very closely with infection control practitioners from our member hospitals who are the experts around the definitions of what is truly a hospital-acquired condition. How do we determine what an infection is? And there's an entire science around that. Now, it is an important science. It's important for the accuracy of the measurement to be there because at the end of the day, we're making sure that the reputations of institutions and individuals are properly conveyed to the public. You don't want to have a higher rate of infection posted when it was truly not that high. So there is a great deal of discussion behind hospital-acquired conditions in our membership and across the country by the infection control practitioners, the folks that are experts in this, to make sure that there's accuracy and validity in the data, because that's at the end of the day, that's what's important. If you're going to make data available to the public, it should be accurate, it should be valid and reliable so that they can choose wisely. And those are some of the technical issues revolving around that particular issue. Now, in studies that we have conducted, we've been able to work with infection control practitioners in defining what hospital onset of MRSA was. And in one study that we conducted here in Central Ohio, we were able to reduce MRSA, onset of MRSA, by 11%. We were able to reduce bloodstream infections of MRSA by over 21%, and 42% reductions have also occurred. Reducing the infections, trying to save lives and reducing cost is all about what we try to do each and every day in the Quality Institute of the Hospital Association and our member hospitals.
Listeners, give us a call. Share your stories about your time in the hospital. Was it good? Was it bad? How do you feel about hospitals having to report so-called hospital-acquired conditions or never events? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or send us an email to allsides@wosu.org. And we'll be right back in just a minute. You're listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News.
FM is your source for NPR news and local news. Stay up to date with issues impacting life in Central Ohio. The award-winning WOSU News team keeps you connected to the community, and the Statehouse News Bureau has the latest in-depth coverage of state government. Listen to news from across the country and from our own backyard on 89.7 NPR News and streaming online at WOSU.org.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and it's 81 degrees in downtown Columbus. Partly sunny skies today and a high of 92 degrees. There is a slight chance of a pop-up thunderstorm. A few clouds tonight and a low of 73. Also a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Some of those storms could be severe. Partly sunny skies for Wednesday and a high of 89. There is a chance of rain on Wednesday as well. And then a few clouds Wednesday night, a low of 68. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Steve Brown, sitting in for Ann Fisher today. And today we're talking about the quality of hospitals. How can we judge hospital performance and preventing hospital mistakes? Still with us is David Engler, Vice President of the Ohio Hospital Association's Quality Institute. And joining us now is Mark Crafton, the Executive Director of State and External Relations for the Joint Commission. That's an independent, non-for-profit that accredits and certifies more than 19,000 healthcare organizations and programs around the country. Before joining the Joint Commission, Mr. Crafton was the Senior Director of the Advocacy for the Michigan Health and Hospital Association. Mark, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you, Steve. It's good to be here.
And your organization accredits and certifies hospitals. We were talking about that just a few minutes ago, but if you could, again, explain the basics of accrediting and certifying hospitals, exactly what that means.
Absolutely. Well, the Joint Commission has been in existence since 1951, and 19,000 organizations asked the Joint Commission to come in and do an on-site inspection every 3 years. We develop standards that help organizations put in place processes that help their patient safety initiatives, help them provide better quality care. We give them an assessment, issue a report, and then work with organizations to come into compliance with all the Joint Commission standards. We also have an arm of our organization that receives complaints from patients, families, regarding our accredited organizations. We get about 10,000 complaints a year. And again, we work with our organizations to make sure those complaints are resolved and addressed.
What are some of the most common complaints you receive?
Well, most of the complaints that we receive are related to things like medication errors that might have occurred in organizations. Certainly receive a lot of complaints about infections that might have occurred in organizations, some of which are related to the care that was given to patients, and some of which, quite frankly, are, you know, through our no fault of the organizations themselves. You know, the patients were just very ill and debilitated and were going to get infections regardless of the care process delivered to that individual patient.
I don't want to get too sensational here, but what are some of the most egregious complaints you've received?
Again, in relation to a lot of the complaints that we receive are actually not from patients, but actually through media outlets. Mm-hmm. So we will monitor patients monitor newspapers and journals throughout the country and monitor that coverage. And then if it involves any of our accredited organizations, we intervene. You know, some of the things that that you might have heard about recently are things like infections that occur in organizations related to unsafe water systems. We might get involved with organizations where a suicide has occurred while the patient has been under the care of the organization. So those are the types of events that that we monitor closely and work with organizations on.
We have a caller right now who seems to have had a complaint. Devin from Marysville. Devin, you had a problem after a transplant, is that correct?
Yeah. Right after a transplant, I had a rejection episode. This was back in 95, just for the record. And I caught meningitis in the hospital. And I was the first of, I think, four or five ultimately that caught it. Part of the troubling part was they did a spinal tap the evening when I was showing the symptoms and to find out if it was, to confirm that it was meningitis, but then also to find if it was viral or bacterial. And they intended that evening to give me a large dose of penicillin in the case that it was bacterial. But there was an oversight. Someone didn't get the memo. And the doctor showed up the next morning saying it is bacterial and at least she got that penicillin last night and I hadn't had it. And she was upset with the interns, but you know, the whole process was messed up.
Mr. Engler or Mr. Crafton, is that something you've heard before? Is that an extreme case? How would you characterize Devin's case?
Thank you, Devin. I hope you're okay now. We have heard issues that of this occurring. This is around what we call the handoffs in communication between our physicians and our nurses, and our hospitals and our labs. We have to do, and we're working on doing a lot better job in making sure that information across the continuum, across the care sites, between the patients, between the physicians, between the laboratories, et cetera, are working better. Electronic health records and electronic information will help this process speed it up in making sure that there's better handoffs and communication. And in fact, I think Mark will reference this through his work, is that a lot of the errors that do occur at these handoffs between diagnosis and treatment, and that was the case here with Devin. The work that we're trying to perform in our hospitals is to make sure that those communication are open and those handoffs are accurate and information is being passed along to make sure that people are appropriately treated for their conditions.
Well, Devin, I'm sorry to hear about your case, but thank you so much for your call this morning. Ross, go ahead. You wanted more information on what are some of the most common errors in hospitals.
That's correct. That was the first question that I heard asked this morning, and what we heard was what hospitals are doing. But I, like many people, like all of us, am a potential patient, and part of me taking responsibility for my own health care is to know what are the things that for which I'm at most risk by accident. And I would think it would be both to the hospital's benefit and mine, my benefit if that question were directly answered.
Mark Crafton, is it possible to directly answer that question given that reporting requirements vary so much from state to state?
Well, it is a difficult question because there really is not a national repository of adverse event information. I think the federal government are taking some steps toward creating that with the development of patient safety organizations throughout the country. But state laws vary greatly. Some states, like Minnesota, require mandatory adverse event reporting with certain defined events that have to be reported. But many states make it voluntary, and some states don't require reporting at all. So it's difficult to, you know, actually come up with a finite list of events and rank them. But some of the things that the Joint Commission is working on, in partnership with leading hospitals and other organizations, are things like wrong site surgery. We know from some of the states that do report adverse events that wrong site surgery occurs as many as 40 times a week across the United States, and that's one of the things that we're working on, making sure that organizations put in place processes to verify the correct person is having the procedure, marking the surgical site, and taking a timeout before the procedure.
David Engler, is this a federal issue? Should we get rid of this patchwork of laws from state to state?
Well, it is a federal, it's a state issue. I think, the notion of greater transparency is occurring throughout the country. As I mentioned, we're moving towards more transparency on outcomes, in particular on infections. Wrong site surgeries or the so-called never events occur with substantial infrequency, considering the numbers of procedures that we're doing. However, that doesn't mean that it's not very important and that it shouldn't be addressed. And as I mentioned, Ohio was the first state in the country to implement a wrong site surgery protocol. We did that not because the federal government or state government said you had to do that, but because we thought it was the right thing to do and appropriate for our patients.
Mark Crafton, how would you compare Ohio to other states as far as reporting requirements and handling of these so-called never events or hospital-acquired conditions?
Well, I'm not intimately familiar with all the workings in Ohio, both their voluntary initiatives through the Hospital Association and the things required by the Ohio Department of Health. But I know that they are a leader in transparency of clinical performance information. There are certain care processes like heart attack, heart failure, pneumonia, surgical site infections, where you can collect process of care data. And Ohio, I know, is a leader in collecting that information and then publishing it on a hospital-specific basis. And that's good information for consumers to have as they're considering their healthcare options.
And we've been speaking about hospitals. We said the word hospital probably 100 times this morning. But Lindsay has a question about outpatient surgery centers. Lindsay, good morning. Thanks for your call.
Yes. I had, 5 years ago, had some outpatient surgery, and I acquired an infection there that affected me for a number of months. I wondered to what extent off-site surgery centers are also accountable, the kind of data they need to submit, either federally or statewide. And also, even though I pressed to see if any malpractice had taken place, they assured me it had not. They went through some committee, but how might I have gone to the American Hospital Association with that question?
Either of you gentlemen, do reporting requirements differ from hospitals to outpatient surgery centers to even a dentist or a dermatologist?
Well, this is Mark. The ambulatory surgery centers are a little bit behind the hospitals in terms of reporting these process of care measures on a national basis. While hospitals have been doing that for up to 10 years now, legislation and rules have just been introduced in Washington to require a comparable type of reporting for outpatient surgery centers. So we'll see that probably within the next 12 months.
And we have John on the air. John, good morning. You have a complaint about a lack of compassion with the care of your mother. Is that right?
Yes. Not too long ago, about 9 months ago, my mom was diagnosed with terminal cancer, and she had gone to Mount Carmel, the James, and also down in Lancaster, and all hospitals basically. She was diagnosed, hey, you've got terminal cancer, you've got about 6 months to live, and Literally, I was with my mother at Mount Carmel East when the doctor walked in and diagnosed her. And, you know, he said, you know, Teresa, you knew it wasn't going to be good. And that was pretty much, you know, his way of saying you've got cancer, you know. And she was treated sort of like a number, you know, just churned in and churned out, you know, and basically told you just go home and write her will, and that was it. Well, my mom is a fighter, and she wasn't going to give up, and she went out to Philadelphia to Cancer Treatment of America. And because of the way she was, you know, also the treatment was a little different out there, but the way that she was treated, she had this new sort of, I don't know, drive to want to survive. And she ended up 3 weeks ago. She went back and they tested and they can't find the cancer. That these three hospitals out here all told her that she should have been dead 3 months ago.
Well, John, I'm happy your mother's okay. I'm sorry for your experience. Mark or David, if reporting is hard to mandate, I'm sure compassion is even harder.
Well, you can't mandate compassion, but obviously there's a growing science around palliative care that is being highly recognized as a very important part for spiritual and body needs, and as well as mental needs and stress that families and the individuals go through. In this case, there is obviously a lack of that. I can't speak to the individual case, but I can say that there's a growing awareness that the family needs to be engaged in these decisions. It needs to be, and we all need to do a better job at the end of life, or what could potentially be the end of life as well. But with inside of this caller's question is another issue, which is whether or not the diagnosis and treatment was appropriate. And we always encourage, and all physicians and surgeons encourage their patients to make sure that they get second and if not third opinions about it. Ask the physician what they would do, what their family members would do in a situation like this. What would you do, doctor? Where would you go? Who are the specialists that can help me? Be very, very aggressive and inquisitive, and take, as I think this gentleman's mother did, take control of the situation and fight. There's nothing wrong with that. I've lost parents, and I've lost siblings to cancer. I know how difficult it is. Getting the kind of information and staying on top of it and making sure that you're receiving all the adequate care you can.
We have an email from a listener who chose not to be identified. My father was hospitalized for a minor heart attack and almost died because no one was paying attention to a malfunctioning automatic blood pressure cuff. When someone finally noticed, they had to rush him to surgery and slice his arm, shoulder to wrist to relieve the blood flow. Also have an email from Jeannie this morning. The best hospital care is only as good as the care after surgery or treatment. My experience at the Cleveland Clinic was a nightmare. The patient care is in the hands of the nursing assistants, who are underpaid, undereducated, and don't want to be there for patients in extreme pain. Again, listeners, please share your stories. Have you had terrible stories in a hospital? Have you had great experiences inside a hospital where the care was fantastic and you thought the nurses and doctors were compassionate and did everything they could to help you along? Give us a call, 292-8513. David Engler from the Quality Institute at the Ohio Hospital Association, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you very much.
And Mark Crafton, please stay with us. In just a moment, we'll be joined also by the Chief Medical Officer of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. You're listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News.
FM is your all-day NPR news station. Listen to local and national news all day, every day. And you can hear the best in classical music on Classical 101. Listen to your favorite composers 24 hours a day and 7 days a week. It's 89.7 NPR News and Classical 101 from WOSU Public Media. For more information, visit WOSU.org.
And this is 89.7 NPR News. Tuesday night joined Frontline to examine the trail that led to the Deepwater Horizon explosion and oil disaster in the Gulf. Could the spill have been prevented? Will BP's corporate culture be forced to change? Watch Frontline, The Spill. It's tonight at 10 on WOSU-TV. And in 20 minutes, beginning at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides begins, a discussion of bath salts, drugs that are marketed as harmless. Join us for that beginning at 11 here on 89.7 NPR News. And it's 81 degrees with partly cloudy skies, some sunshine today, a high of 92. There is a slight chance of a pop-up thunderstorm this afternoon. Cloudy tonight and a low of 73, a better chance of showers and thunderstorms. Some of those storms could be severe overnight. And then partly sunny for Wednesday, a high of 89 with a chance of rain. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Good morning. Thanks for listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News. I'm sitting in for Ann Fisher today. Good morning. I'm Steve Brown. This hour, we're talking about the problem of medical mistakes by hospitals and what can be done about it and how can we judge the quality of hospitals. Still with us on the line is Mark Crafton, the Executive Director of State and External Relations for the Joint Commission. That's an independent nonprofit that accredits and certifies hospitals in Ohio and around the country. And joining us now also is Dr. Patrick Conway, the Chief Medical Officer of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, commonly known as CMS. Dr. Conway is responsible for administering federal health care quality initiatives and setting the government's quality agenda. Before joining CMS, Dr. Conway was a pediatric hospitalist and director of hospital medicine at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center. Dr. Conway, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
And we talked about this earlier in the show, but to recap, data on hospital-acquired conditions collected by CMS was originally scheduled to be published in September of last year, but was met with strong resistance from hospital groups such as the American Hospital Association. Is there a conflict there still present between CMS and hospitals on how data on hospital mistakes should be collected and reported?
We are working closely with the American Hospital Association, and we believe we've found common ground. I think we share a common goal to reduce and eliminate as much as possible all healthcare acquired conditions. So I believe we have a common goal, and certainly in our programs, we're focused on eliminating harm to patients.
They surely do want to eliminate harm to patients, but they also have to run their facilities. Is there somewhat of a conflict of interest there, possibly, in regard to reporting these events? Will they always willingly come forward?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, we are to improve, and I can say this from my previous role working in a hospital. I mean, the first step is to identify these events and then focus on the improvement step. We're trying to enable hospitals to identify these events and focus on the improvement through our Partnership for Patients campaign. We're launching a major initiative, and part of that initiative is basically twofold. One is reducing safety events in hospitals, and then the second part is reducing readmissions to hospitals. So I agree these safety events can be difficult, but I think we're focused on reducing them across the board and aligning incentives to empower hospitals to eliminate these safety events.
So again, specifics on the best way to reduce them, along with reporting, what else can CMS or regulatory agencies do to really drive down the instance of wrong size surgeries or bed sores or hospital acquired infections? What else can be done?
Yeah, so we are including some of these measures in our hospital value-based purchasing program. So it's a program that starting in 2012, hospitals' payment will be adjusted based on their performance, and it includes a focus on these safety events. Also, through our healthcare acquired conditions program, we're looking at adjustment of payments to hospitals both based on these events. Not so long ago, if there was one of these events, hospitals could actually charge additional revenue for the complications, and we've removed that from the program so that that cannot be done. So we're really addressing this program from this issue from a multitude of angles on the federal level.
This question might be better suited for Mr. Crafton. I'm not sure, but how much do billing does the billing issues, the patients being charged for these botched procedures or infections that they get, how does that differ from Medicare and Medicaid to private insurance? I know Medicare will no longer pay for these hospital-acquired conditions, but what about private insurance?
Well, it really varies from insurer to insurer. In fact, some of the private insurers, like United Healthcare out of Minnesota, you know, actually led the way with that non-payment policy for certain never events. And then that was the federal government through Medicare and states through Medicaid followed suit shortly thereafter. But again, it's a little bit of variability for each of the thousands of different payer organizations throughout the country.
Mark, were you trying to jump in there? Oh, I'm sorry, was that? Forgive me, I'm getting mixed up with the callers. Two male voices here this morning. Dr. Conway, you were how good is hospital oversight in this country? I know you have a lot of experience here in Ohio. I'm not sure. Can you compare Ohio and maybe the U.S. to countries abroad, or how would you rate hospital oversight in Ohio and the country?
Yeah. So I mean, I think hospitals are moving in the right direction. I certainly have worked in a number of hospital health systems that were getting close to eliminating a lot of these safety events in the patient population. So I think, you know, we have pockets of incredible success in this country. And then I think the goal would be, how do we spread that success nationwide? So if as a patient or a beneficiary you're admitted to the hospital, you know, you have the lowest possible risk of having one of these safety events occur.
We have Betty on the line who had an issue with a lack of communication with an out-of-state hospital, I believe. Betty, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. My situation had to deal with the death of my father. My father was in the hospital in Massachusetts with a very serious condition. It wasn't expected that he would die. My brothers, who both live in different states, and I were taking turns being there. And during one of the transition times, he died during the night of a massive heart attack. Nobody called us to tell us. We didn't find out for almost 2 days when we called them, because no one was able to find him. His friends couldn't find him in the hospital. We couldn't. He wasn't able to answer the phone often. So when he didn't answer, when there was no answer, we were not worried until we called and there was someone else in the room. And the one other interesting thing I remembered from the experience when I was up there with him, there was a sign in the nurse's station that doctors inform families of death. So there, that's our sad story, my dad's sad story.
Well, Betty, I'm sorry to hear about that. Dr. Conway or Mark Crafton, anything you'd like to add on that? Is that a common complaint as far as family members not being kept up to date?
Well, this is Mark. I think communication is an area that every organization can improve upon, and this certainly sounds like an example of just such an instance. And I think if families experience that kind of a breakdown in communication, and certainly there's a couple of avenues that one can take. Certainly if it's a Joint Commission accredited organization and you've brought the issue to the attention of the facility and you don't feel like it's being resolved adequately, certainly 12,000 people a year make complaints to the Joint Commission. And they can do that via our website, which is www.jointcommission.org. And we have a team of healthcare professionals that analyze complaints and then get in touch with the organizations that we accredit to try to address those issues.
Howard's been on hold for quite some time. Howard, good morning. Thanks for your call.
I had a problem almost 4 years ago. I checked into a hospital, a small hospital that specializes in orthopedic surgery. And I had I had bone surgery. But the thing I didn't like about this hospital is that they do a horrible job of treating people who have co-occurring medical conditions that are independent of their orthopedic condition. For example, ever since I was 19 years old, I've always had to wear an ostomy bag because I had my entire colon removed. And I was shocked after I got into this hospital and after I had my surgery that the hospital did not carry ostomy supplies. And I was forced to sign myself out of the hospital against medical advice just so I could go home and change my ostomy bag.
Well, Howard, I'm sorry for your case there, Dr. Conway or Mr. Crafton. Is that a common complaint, just as much as human error is a lack of adequate supplies on hand?
So this is Patrick Conway. I'll start. Likewise, very sorry to hear about this. I mean, I think a couple issues. One is I think the care coordination aspects is certainly a common complaint, and we're trying to put more incentives in place for care coordination. I think also speaking from personal experience, I think, you know, enabling hospital systems to take care of the whole hospital systems and healthcare systems more broadly, including outside of the hospital, to take care of the whole patient. So, you know, through things like primary care medical homes and accountable care organizations and bundled payments, we're trying to align incentives so that healthcare providers focus on the whole patient and taking care of the entire patient.
Well, I've tried my best this morning to not be too unfair or to be not unfair at all for hospitals, but I think we have a positive comment about a hospital now. Nancy from Circleville, go ahead, you're on the air.
I would like to say that I had two cancer surgeries in Berger Hospital. First of all, when I had a mammogram, it was found right away. It was taken care of that day. They scheduled me before even I knew it. My Dr. McCoy did that. Then I was sent to Dr. Boone, who was absolutely wonderful. He did two surgeries. Berger Hospital, honest to goodness, the people that cleaned the floor, the nurses, the anesthesiologists, everyone was wonderful. I mean, I could not have been treated better. Each surgery was, I felt completely safe.
Well, Nancy,
they did everything for me. If you want special care, Berger Hospital, I couldn't recommend it higher.
Well,
it was great.
Nancy, I'm so happy to hear that. Thanks for your call. We also have an email from Ernie. I recently had a hernia operation. The surgeon asked me what and where and then immediately marked the area of operation with a black X. We heard about that from Mr. Engler this morning. And Ernie also writes that he thought that was smart and he thinks reporting problems should be mandatory. So we obviously have some listeners split on the issue here. Let's go now to James calling from Columbus. James, thanks for your call this morning. You're on the air.
Thank you. My wife died of cancer because she was denied treatment under a clinical trial after a successful initial surgery at a major hospital because the patient finance department demanded $150,000 up front from us, despite the fact that the clinical trial was already funded by the pharmaceutical company. So they wanted to double dip, and the insurance company refused to pay for it because they said it was experimental and therefore wasn't covered under her health insurance. So they just let her die.
Dr. Conway or Mr. Crafton, feel free to jump in here. Is money a root of some of these disputes and some of these problems? Some of these hospital acquired conditions, or a lot of hospital of patient complaints, is money often one of the root causes?
So,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was debating if Dr. Kraft was going to jump in. I mean, I think you know, certainly on a private insurer, I can't pretend to know all the issues of the given case. I do apologize for the listener's loss. You know, I think these coverage issues are very difficult. I will say on the clinical trials policy and Medicare coverage. We are looking at that right now to make sure that we set up a system that allows patients to be in clinical trials. Not a direct answer to the question, but I think this is an issue that we need to look at and make sure that our clinical trials policy, and at least on the Medicare side, we're aligned in encouraging participation in trials that have the potential to benefit patients, and we learn from the results.
Sure. And James, I'm so sorry for the loss of your wife there. John, calling from Pickerington, has a suggestion. John, good morning.
Yes, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well, sir. Go ahead.
Good. I just wanted to make a suggestion that I think impacts the hospitals. It impacts each individual patient. It impacts our cost of health care, and that's electronic health records, which the government is paying the doctors to. A friend of mine was telling me about it. Ohio is leading the way in an electronic health record, which allows, for example, if you were in a hospital here, you went on vacation afterward, you were in Florida or someplace, had to be readmitted. The moment you walked in there, they would have all of your electronic health records of everything that happened in the hospital in Ohio, everything that happened at the pharmacy. It connects you. It connects your doctor to the lab, to the hospitals, to your primary care, to any specialist. It's one record that everybody's dumping your medical information into, and it's something that I think patients, if your doctor doesn't have this, I'm going to ask my doctor to get it because I need to be in this loop, and I think it impacts the quality of hospital care as much as it does anything, but it's really patient-centered, and I don't know why doctors aren't rushing to it because they're being paid by the taxpayers to do it.
John, thanks for your call this morning. Dr. Conway and Mark Crafton, are doctors indeed rushing to convert to electronic records to make these mistakes less often, to make them happen less often?
Dr. Conway, I'll start. It is a large initiative of the federal government right now to incentivize the use of electronic health records. We have evidence that overall it can increase care coordination, decrease medical errors, and improve the quality of care. I've been in multiple health systems and went through electronic health record implementations. There are at times some resistance on the provider side, but I think once you get through that initial adoption phase, the electronic health record is incredibly helpful to coordinate.
Dr. Conway, I'm sorry, we're up against the clock. We could talk about this all day. Patrick Conway is the chief medical officer for CMS, and also Mark Crafton from the Joint Commission. Thank you both so much for your time this morning.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.
And we'll be back next hour for a discussion on drugs marketed as harmless products. That's here on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.